Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I'm so glad you're joining us today because we're looking at something that keeps almost every infrastructure engineer awake at night.
Yeah, the absolute dread of scaling.
Right. You know, usually when you launch a new piece of software, everyone is just obsessed with the features.
Oh, totally. The shiny stuff.
Exactly. It's like opening an exclusive new club. You're entirely focused on like the sound system, the lighting, getting the VIP guests in the door.
The fun parts of the gym.
Yeah. But nobody ever wants to think about the plumbing or, you know, the security doors or the fire exits. At least not until it's a Saturday night. The place is completely packed and suddenly a pipe bursts while someone is trying to sneak into the DJ booth.
Right. The classic day 100 crisis.
It's
chaotic. And frankly, it's astronomically expensive to fix when the room's already full of people.
So true.
We love building the tools, but we historically just hate building the infrastructure that protects them.
Which brings us to exactly what we are covering today. We are pulling apart a masterclass document specifically. It's chapter 5 from a course on the Model Context Protocol, or MCP.
A really fascinating read, yeah.
It really is. It's titled Gateways, Audit Logs, and Shipping to a 1,000-User Team. And our mission for you today is pretty simple. We want to shortcut the painful lessons that most engineering teams just learn the hard way.
Usually at 2 a.m. on a weekend.
Exactly. So we're going to figure out how you can scale a single MCT server to a massive team without it collapsing under the weight of security holes or leak state or totally flooded storage partitions.
Because it's a transition every successful tool eventually has to make.
Right.
The moment you move an MCP server from your local machine into, you know, a real production environment where 20 different teams and their various AI agents are calling it simultaneously, the physics of the system just completely change.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the author starts with a really contrarian premise regarding how we usually handle that transition.
Yeah, they do.
Because most teams just bolt on security and tracking as a total afterthought. It usually happens right after a breach, or when someone in management suddenly asks, hey, who called that disruptive database tool last Tuesday?
And everyone just panics.
Right. The engineering team just stares at their shoes because the audit trail literally does not exist.
Yes, the classic bolt-on approach. But the source argues strongly against this. They make a contrarian, purely economic argument. You need to deploy an MCP gateway on day one, not day 100.
Day one.
Day one.
Yeah.
And the reasoning is that setting up an open source gateway like the MCP gateway reference implementation, they discuss, it literally takes less than 2 hours.
Wait, 2 hours? That's basically a long lunch break in engineering time.
Exactly. It's nothing. And in those 2 hours, you gain transparent token validation, role-based access control, rate limiting, and a perfectly structured audit log.
Oh, wow.
And the real kicker, you get all of this without touching a single line of your underlying server code.
That is wild.
Yeah, the gateway acts as a reverse proxy. It intercepts the JSON RPC frames, checks the rules, and if everything looks good, it just forwards them on. Neither the client nor the server needs to be aware that the gateway even exists.
So it's literally a highly efficient bouncer at that exclusive club we were talking about earlier.
That's a perfect way to look at it, yeah.
Like, this gateway bouncer doesn't just glance at your ID and wave you through before you even get to speak to the bartender, who I guess is the actual upstream server in this analogy. The bouncer checks exactly which VIP rooms you're allowed in.
Right.
They track exactly how fast you're drinking so you don't overdo it, and they keep a meticulous chronological ledger of every single move you make. All of that computation happens right at the front door.
The gateway handles the logistics of the club, so the bartender can just focus entirely on mixing the drinks.
I love that. Okay, so a transparent gateway saves us from having to touch the server code. But wait, if the gateway doesn't share code with the server, how does it actually know the rules of the club?
What do you mean?
Like it's flying blind, right? How does it know which tools require admin privileges versus which ones are just read-only?
Okay. This is where auto-discovery comes in, and it's a very elegant mechanism. The MCP specification defines a specific endpoint for this. It's .well-known mcp.json.
Okay.
The gateway pulls this endpoint on the upstream server automatically. By default, it checks in every 5 minutes. The server uses this JSON document to advertise its capabilities to the gateway, and that includes a crucial map called scopes required.
Oh, I see. So the server is essentially just handing the bouncer the rule book.
Precisely. The scopes required map tells the gateway exactly which OF scopes are needed to execute specific methods or specific tools.
Okay, that makes sense.
In the multi-tenant deployments the 2026 MCP roadmap recommends, we generally see two canonical scopes. You have tools.read and tools.admin.
So by defaulting to tools.read for service accounts, we inherently sandbox things like our CI/CD pipelines.
Exactly.
So even if an agent gets hijacked, the gateway physically prevents it from making destructive POST requests upstream. But let's test this least privilege idea.
Okay, let's do it.
Say I'm a user. My token only has the tools.read scope, but I decide I want to be sneaky, and I try to call the delete branch tool anyway. Does the gateway just pretend the tool doesn't exist? Like, do I get a 404 not found error?
No, you do not get a 404. What you get is a 403 forbidden.
Oh, interesting. So it doesn't hide the infrastructure from me?
No, it doesn't. And what's fascinating here is that transparent enforcement prevents so much operational overhead. The tool isn't hidden. You can still see it in the tools list directory.
Right, because you might actually need to know it's there.
Exactly. But when the gateway validates your token, it checks your granted scopes against that scopes required map we talked about. Your token says tools.read, but the rulebook says delete branch requires tools.admin.
So you get blocked.
Right. So the gateway steps in and returns a 403 forbidden with a clear JSON RPC error payload.
Wait, if the gateway is intercepting every single JSON RPC frame to check tokens and cross-reference scopes, isn't that adding massive latency to every single request?
You would think so, but that's the beauty of stateless JWT JSON Web Token validation. The gateway doesn't have to make a database round trip to an auth server to check your permissions.
Oh, because it's all in the token itself.
Exactly. The scopes are baked into the token. The gateway just verifies the cryptographic signature on the JWT locally using a cached public key. That takes microseconds. It's computationally trivial.
Which means the upstream server, our bartender, and never even had to deal with the request or waste compute power.
Not a single cycle.
The bouncer just stopped you at the door and said, I know you can see the VIP room, but you just don't have the wristband.
And because it's a 403 instead of a 404, the user knows exactly what went wrong. They can go request elevated access if they actually need it, rather than filing a bug report with your support team saying the tool is missing.
That saves so many unnecessary support tickets. Now, what happens if the wristband expires while you're inside? Say my AI agent is mid-conversation, streaming a response, and the token hits its expiration time.
This is actually one of the primary failure modes the document warns about. They call them silent session deaths.
Oof, sounds bad.
It is. The next tool call returns a 401 unauthorized error. If the client application doesn't know how to proactively refresh that token in the background, the session just dies.
So it just hangs.
Yeah, the LLM stops responding. The user has absolutely no idea why.
So how do you fix that?
The mitigation here relies entirely on the client side. Your client architecture must proactively refresh tokens before they expire, and the gateway must return proper standard authentication headers so the client understands the rejection in the first place.
Okay, so we block the bad requests and we're handling authentication gracefully, but eventually we are going to need to prove all of this to an auditor.
Oh, inevitably.
Let's say we're going through a SOC 2 Type 2 audit, which requires you to answer the 5 W's for literally any system action. So who performed it? What they did, when they did it, with what parameters, and what happened as a result.
And SOC2 audits are notoriously where a lot of custom-built day 100 architectures completely fall apart.
I can imagine.
But the MCP gateway handles this out of the box. Using structured JSON lines audit logs, one JSON object per new line. And the schema they use has some really brilliant design decisions tailored specifically for these audits.
Yeah, let's look at the with what part the actual arguments pass to a tool. Because the document explicitly says we should never log raw tool arguments.
Never.
Instead, the MCP schema logs an archhash, which is a SHA-256 hash of the serialized JSON arguments. But wait, hold on. If I'm an auditor investigating a security breach, a hash doesn't tell me what malicious code or prompt injection the user actually typed.
Right.
Doesn't hashing defeat the entire purpose of an audit log?
It sounds totally counterintuitive, I know. But it's a critical security boundary. Think about what goes into those arguments.
Like what?
API keys, personally identifiable information, proprietary source code. If you log raw arguments, your audit log just became your biggest security liability. It's a massive honeypot.
Okay, fair point. If someone hacks the logs, they get everything. So how do we actually audit it then?
You use the hash for correlation. The auditor takes the archhash from the gateway's chronological timeline and matches it against the client's local highly encrypted storage of the actual inputs.
Oh.
Yeah, it proves when the action happened and who did it at the network layer without exposing the payload to the infrastructure team managing the logs.
That makes total sense. Keep the PII completely out of the infrastructure.
And speaking of the who part, the schema uses a user subclaim. And this isn't just pulled from some basic bear token that could be stolen.
No, this is pulled directly from a DPOP token, a demonstration of proof of possession token.
DPOP. Okay, how does that actually work mechanically compared to just a normal token?
Well, a standard bearer token is like a physical hotel key card. If you drop it in the hallway, anyone who picks it up can unlock your room. Bad news.
Exactly. A DPOP token is fundamentally different. It's tied cryptographically to a private key that's generated on the client's device. For every single request, the client has to sign it with that private key. The gateway then verifies that the signature matches the public key bound to the token.
So even if an attacker intercepts the token over the network, they can't use it because they don't have the client's private key to sign the request.
Exactly. And from an audit perspective, that means the action is non-repudiable.
Meaning they can't deny doing it.
Right. A user cannot claim, oh, someone else must have stolen my token and made that request. The cryptography mathematically proves it originated from their specific client instance.
The auditors are going to love that. Yeah. There's one more detail in this logging schema that I think is just a brilliant engineering trick. For the request ID, they do not use UIDs. They use ULIDs.
Universally unique lexicographically sortable identifiers.
Yeah, that's a mouthful.
The critical word there being sortable.
Right. Because UIDs are completely random. They are great for uniqueness, but they are absolutely terrible for databases.
Oh, the worst.
But ULIDs are 128-bit identifiers where the first 48 bits actually represent a timestamp, and the rest is randomness. What that means structurally is that they naturally sort chronologically.
It's a massive performance optimization. When your database is searching through terabytes of audit logs to find everything that happened between, say, 2.00 p.m. and 2.05 p.m., ULIDs allow it to sequential scan instead of jumping all over the index.
Which makes searches massively faster.
Exactly.
And while we are talking about logging, we have to mention a technical quirk from the source that you absolutely need to remember if you are building this.
Oh, the Stordio thing.
Yes. If your MCP server is using the standard input-output transport Stordio, you must configure the server to write its local logs to Spoder, not Starter.
This is critical because Studeout is the actual JSON RPC communication channel.
Right.
If your server writes a random plain text log line to Studeout, it gets injected directly into the JSON RPC stream. You will instantly corrupt the stream and break the connection between the gateway and the server. Starter is the safe out-of-band channel for logging.
Good to know. Okay, so we're generating this massive, perfect ledger for the auditors. But wait, if I have 1,000 users and they're all making like 60 calls a minute, that's tens of thousands of log lines a minute. Aren't we just going to completely crash the server's hard drive?
Well, you've just identified failure mode number 4 from the document, which is log storage saturation.
Ah.
Yeah, if you do the math on that, it's about 26 gigabytes of JSON files generated every single day. If you're writing those to a local var log partition, your server will literally run out of space and crash within 24 hours.
Okay, so what's the architectural fix for that?
You must configure the gateway to stream those logs directly to an external observability backend, like Datadog or Loki.
Yeah.
You never store audit logs on the local disk in a production environment.
Okay, got it. So they are allowed in the club, and we are safely streaming a log of their actions. But what if an authorized user's AI agent just goes into a loop? What if it hallucinates and tries to call a database tool 1,000 times in 10 seconds?
You have to protect your servers from flooding. And honestly, you have to protect your LLM API budget from runaway agents.
Seriously.
The gateway achieves this using a classic token bucket algorithm. Every user gets a bucket with a certain number of tokens. Every request costs 1 token. The bucket refills at a steady rate, but if an agent drains the bucket completely, the gateway drops the hammer and sends back a 429 too many request response.
And crucially, it includes a retry after header. A well-behaved MCP client will read that header, pause its execution, and automatically retry only after that specific time has elapsed.
Exactly.
But I have a puzzle for you based on a real-world scenario from the text.
Okay, hit me.
Let's say a colleague is running an automated batch job making 50 calls a minute. That is totally within their limit. You're sitting right next to them in the office, connected to the exact same Wi-Fi network. You try to make one single interactive call to the server, and instantly you get a 429 error. Your bucket is empty, even though you haven't done anything today. Why?
Because the gateway was misconfigured to use IP-based rate limiting. It's a classic trap. Everyone sitting behind the same office router or the same NAT appears as a single IP address to the gateway. So you and your colleague are forced to share the exact same token bucket. Their 50 calls plus your one call push that shared IP bucket over the limit.
So how does the gateway differentiate us without adding a bunch of slow database lookups?
You switch the rate limit key from the IP address to the user subclaim in the token. When the request comes in, the gateway parses the JWT header again, in microseconds extracts that cryptographic user identity, and uses that as the key for the bucket.
That is so clean.
Yeah, now every single user gets their own independent token bucket, regardless of what network they're sitting on.
But what if my colleague's batch script genuinely needs to make a quick burst of, say, 100 calls? If the burst limit is universally set to 10 calls to protect against rogue agents, that legitimate script gets a 429 error and crashes mid-batch. It leaves their resources in a totally inconsistent state.
Right. And this is failure mode number 5, rate limit false positives.
Yeah.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it highlights why you need flexible policies based on identity.
How so?
The mitigation here is to differentiate your rate limits based on the cliented claim in the token. Standard interactive clients get a lower burst limit. Known, authenticated backend services running batch scripts get assigned a higher burst allowance.
That makes a lot of sense. And if a user does get blocked, how do we know if it was a rate limit or if someone just accidentally changed the club rules overnight?
You ensure your audit logs capture the direct policy version.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, if a legitimate call is blocked today but it worked yesterday, capturing the policy version tells your support team instantly if the well-known file was modified upstream. It catches gateway misconfigurations before they turn into major incidents.
That is incredibly smart. Okay, let's talk about growing the club. If our user base grows to 1,000 people, one single bouncer and one single front door isn't going to cut it. We need a load balancer and we need multiple server instances.
And that introduces the most rigid architectural rule of the entire framework. Your servers must be completely stateless across requests.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because if you aren't careful, you can accidentally build state into your server without even realizing it.
Happens all the time.
Let's say a developer decides to optimize a workflow. They cache a user's GitHub API token in the server's local memory so they don't have to re-authenticate it on every single tool call.
And that works perfectly fine when you only have one instance running on your laptop.
Right. But the moment you have two doors and two bouncers behind a load balancer, you have a massive problem. Request 1 goes to instance A. The token is cached in memory. Request 2 from the same user goes to instance B.
And instance B doesn't have the cache.
Exactly. The tool suddenly fails. Your user gets...
You simply run at least 2 of them behind your cloud provider's load balancer in an active setup. If one crashes, the load balancer automatically routes traffic to the healthy one while the other reboots.
Simple enough. Okay, let's take a breath.
It's a lot of info.
It is. So what does this all mean? We've covered a massive amount of technical ground today. By embracing that contrarian premise, by putting a gateway in front of your server on day one, you skip months of painful trial and error.
Absolutely.
You let the gateway auto-discover the rules via the dot well-known endpoint. You leverage JWT parsing to check scopes in microseconds. You use the user sub and rshash to log smart, keeping PII out of your infrastructure.
Crucial step.
Right. And you avoid the IP rate limiting trap. And you keep your servers totally stateless so you can scale horizontally behind a load balancer. By doing all of that, you are fully equipped to deploy an MCP system that can handle 1,000 users without breaking a sweat. At the end of the day, robust architecture is ultimately just about protecting the user experience.
And quite frankly, protecting the engineering team's sleep schedule.
Absolutely. But before we wrap up, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over, something that builds on everything we've just discussed today.
Okay, let's hear it.
We've talked extensively today about static RBAC policies and strict rate limits. The bouncer has a list and the list does not change. But as AI agents become more sophisticated, they're going to become more autonomous. They will start reasoning about their own urgency and priorities.
That's a fascinating trajectory.
Right. So what happens when an advanced agent realizes it's right in the middle of a mission-critical batch job and it predicts it's about to hit a rate limit?
Oh, wow.
Could future MCP gateways allow agents to dynamically negotiate with the bouncer? Could they provide a cryptographic proof of their current task context to request a temporary burst limit, or even request elevated scopes on the fly? If the gateway is the bouncer at the club, what happens when the VIPs start dynamically negotiating their own rules right there at the door?
It's a completely new paradigm for infrastructure. It moves from static rules to dynamic, context-aware negotiation.
Something to think about as you architect your next server. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.